everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Women's Wednesday is the day that we focus on issues of particular import, particular impact to women. And today's guest is going to be talking to us about an issue that affects too many women, affects men, but certainly affects many, many women. Too many women, too often. I'm very pleased to introduce you to Tamara Neal, who is a certified relationship coach and the author of Venomous Relationships: Learn How to Avoid Common Relationship Bloopers. Tamara Neal, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. It is a honor to be on your show.
Well, Tamara, you just heard me say that this is something that affects men, but also affects women, and affects women, from what we know, significantly more often than men. We don't want anybody affected by domestic violence, but in fact, many people are. And you have written a book that is based not only on your own personal experiences, but on your professional experiences as, of all things, a 911 emergency communication technician. What does that mean, and what did you do, and what was that like for you?
Okay, well, you said a mouthful there. You're so right. I narrow it all down. I've been there, I've done that, and I wrote the book. I, for many years, while working as a Baltimore County 911 operator, I found myself the only help available on the other end of the line while people experience some of the most horrific, violent domestics that the human mind could possibly imagine. I mean, I have a lot of stories to tell. But not only do I have a lot of stories to tell that were work-related through thousands of calls, I also have stories of my own. So that's why I say I've been there, I've done that, wrote the book.
Well, let's start with your own personal stories. And then I'd like to talk a little bit more about just the experience of being a 911 emergency communication tech. But let's start first with your story. What was your life like?
What was my life like? Okay, well, I was involved in what I look back now on and could say is a venomous relationship, was a venomous relationship. It's sort of difficult for me to talk about it, not because I don't want to expose my past, but because I have left that so far in my past, I am no longer... It's almost even hard to drag it all back up. I'm actually a good friend with my exes, and all of them live in Texas. So it's like, so it's sort of, and I'm just being as honest with you as I can, you know. But I mean, I've suffered from, I have a dating experience that really stays so fresh in my mind, probably because I never saw that person again and had the opportunity to resolve it. But my relationship abuse stemmed around emotional abuse. Mm-hmm. Whenever you're mistreated in a relationship, anybody that's being mistreated is ultimately being abused, because abuse is abnormal use. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So if you're in a relationship where it affects your self-worth, where your self-worth has been affected, and when I talk about abuse, I try to go into that common abuse in my book, that common relationship abuse that often gets overlooked, because everybody thinks abuse is a black eye. And it's not always a black eye. You know, you can be an abusive. If I get up in your face and I yell and scream at you loud enough, then I am abusing you.
And
that is it's actually an assault.
It absolutely is, and it's terrifying to the person who's on the other end. And you know, the other really important thing about emotional abuse is that that's usually the beginning. That's sort of laying the groundwork for the physical abuse. So you're absolutely right. It cannot be ignored. And many people, and many people do.
That's right. So those are the first steps. There isn't a chapter in my book. I bring up 10 venomous relationships, and there isn't a chapter in that book that doesn't get you to that violent domestic. Because, like you said, it begins, it starts somewhere. So that's like the chapters in the book are the scenarios, are the root of the violent domestic, the very beginning. So we can't get to the end without the beginning.
Well, that's true. Tell us about that dating experience.
Okay, well, with the dating experience, I was newly divorced, and I was taking a much-needed walk through a park with a cousin. And I remember this like it was yesterday. I start reliving it when I tell the story. But I'm walking through the park, and this gentleman drove by, and he said, "There she is," and he made a U-turn. He said, "I must have your number." So when he said this, looking at this guy, Dr. Brewer, I wasn't attracted to him, to say the least, because, I mean, the first thing is physical when you look at a person. So I'm not attracted to this guy. I would have never, under any other circumstances, given him my number. It punched me in the stomach when he said, "There she is," like it just hit me straight in the gut. And I spit my number out. There I am, 555, you know, and I'm giving him my number. So when he started calling, and mind you, he started calling right away, and he was calling more than I cared to receive his calls. So that was sort of like a flare there.
Absolutely.
But it was something about his conversation that just totally, you know, just every time I got off the phone, I got off the phone with a bad feeling. So it took 6 months for me to wake up one morning feeling sort of like I didn't want to be alone anymore with myself, sort of being upset with, not comfortable in my own skin. So I said to myself, made a conscious decision, if that phone rings, I'm going out of here. And lo and behold, the phone rang, and why was it him? So he invited me to his house for dinner. I'm so caught off guard because I'm bent on the promise that I had already made to myself. So I quickly called my aunt up, and she came over to watch my two little boys. When he got to the, gave him my address. Since I had been talking to him on the phone for 6 months, I guess I figured he wasn't a stranger anymore. Gave him my address. He came to my house. He was shocked when he saw me. The first thing out of his mouth was, "What happened to your skin?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You were so much darker." And so my aunt, she laughed. God bless her soul. She's gone and moved on the other side. And she laughed, and she said, "Oh, we're a lot lighter. We're a lot darker here in the summer." It was winter time then.
Okay.
So we get in the car. We're not talking the whole ride. It is like dead silence. He pulls up in front of this big house, and all of a sudden he starts talking about his ex-wife that he would never go into any detail about when we first met. He started talking about the relationship they had, the big, beautiful wedding they had, how people came from all over the world, and he looked almost like he was going into a trance, and then he pulled off. We arrived at this apartment. I'm sitting in, like, this little dinette area. He's in the kitchen. All of a sudden, he's ready to cut up this meat. He goes in the drawer. He pulls out this knife. He said, "My ex-wife cheated on me while I was out of the country." He said, "Everyone wanted to, you know, was so surprised because we had such a beautiful union." He said, "For many years, I thought of finding a woman that looked like her and killing her." And then he pointed his knife at me, and he said, "My ex-wife looked just like you." Right at that moment, I went to that, "There she is," that day in the park. When he said, "There she is," that was a flare going off. That was something hitting me in my gut, telling me, you know, okay, it's something about, why is it, how come I never asked? That's what I beat myself up about to this day. I never asked, "What did you mean by there she is?"
Well, you know, one of the things about abusive relationships, and you've kind of, you know, listed so many things that are part of the pattern. First of all, you know, he sort of surprises you, and it's kind of, you know, a little bit sexy, a little bit exciting. You know, somebody just changes their whole life because they've seen the love of their life and it's you. I mean, you know, how many people, in all seriousness, how many people would just sort of blow that off and not pay attention to it? Of course you're going to pay attention to it. But what's interesting is that, you know, the assumption is, there are a lot of things that are interesting about that initial reaction. The assumption is that he's talking about how completely amazing and glorious you are. Why wouldn't you think that? That's what anybody would think. The other thing is, against your, you didn't pay attention to your better judgment. He caught you off guard. And how many women in particular do not pay attention to their better judgment? Then he's being intrusive in your life. He's calling you more than you want. And, you know, that's a red flag. He's really crossing the boundaries. Deciding that you know somebody enough to give them your home address simply because you've talked to them on the phone. You know, these are all really common things that people do. Men and women do them. They're really common. But women, you know, in some ways are a lot more susceptible to "there she is" and "I can't live my life without you. I've got to call you every day."
That's right. It's so true. And, you know, you touched on so many valid points because we as kids, we're raised to look for little girls. They're taught to look for that knight in shining armor, that guy on the white horse. You know, at first glance, I thought it was me just being ego-driven because I was very ego-driven back then. And it can get you into, you know, it can, you make yourself very vulnerable when you think so highly of yourself that a person can almost tell you anything and you're going to believe it.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, you're the best looking thing I've seen in years. And of course, why would he be lying?
Because you are.
So that ego, you know, that ego will get you in trouble every time. But that knight in shining armor thing, and I do have the knight in shining armor. Well, he's in the other book, but the knight, I named this guy Dr. Respectable Mr. Hyde. But, yes, so true.
And you know, the women have also been taught to ignore their instincts. And it really has gotten better in terms of how little girls are being taught these days. But it's still a part of how women and girls sort of think about themselves and are taught by still many people and certainly by society. Don't pay attention to your instincts. That's not important. And you didn't pay attention to your instincts. And, you know, the other thing that I think is just so important about this is, you know, there are all kinds of ways to interpret odd behavior, right? So this guy, you know, takes you to this huge, beautiful house. He's talking about his wife. I could see any number of women saying, oh, he feels so comfortable with me that he wants to share his deepest hurt. I need to help him. I need to save him.
That's so true. But everything inside of me was telling me that I needed to get out of that car, and I was trying to figure out, how can I get out of this date without having the date, because I had stood that guy up so many times with changing my mind. Even when I kissed my little boys, you know, as I was leaving, there was something inside of me that said, don't go. I almost felt like crying, like I was kissing them goodbye. So everything, I was real in tune to my gut instinct because I was a 911 operator. Right. You cannot be a 911 operator and make it. I trained many operators. You will not make it 6 months if you don't get in touch with your gut instinct, because there is absolutely nothing in a manual that will be able to prepare you for everything that a human being can possibly think of that will be invented at the time of your call, the call that you're getting, you know. If you're not in tune to your gut, you will not be able to respond appropriately, because some things you have to just have a natural gut instinct about. There are a lot of gut decisions in a 911 center that are made regularly on a daily basis that people are so unaware of. And you may be the unsung hero every day when you go to work, but that one mistake We'll have you on world news.
Well, that's true. You know, the other piece that you're talking to us about, which is so important, you were, in ways that many people will never be, an expert in terms of not only paying to your gut, as you said, but really having a sense that something's not quite right. There's something going on here. You were an expert, but you were also a human being. And so many times I hear women in particular saying, beating themselves up, why didn't I know? Why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that? Because you're human. You have the expertise, and even you're human, and you made a decision that, you know, hindsight is always ingenious.
Right.
You made a real decision that, you know, is a common one to make. In that moment, you didn't pay attention to yourself. And how often do we do that? Just as human beings, we don't pay attention to ourselves.
That's so true. And you know what, Dr. Brewer, you actually helped me in more ways than you will ever know just with that statement, because I have done so many shows, and I think you're the first host that ever really broke that part down. That you actually gave me a free session just now. I guess that's the difference between a coach. I'm a coach, and I try to break that down to people. I'm a certified relationship coach. I am not a counselor. I am not a therapist. I am not a psychiatrist. What I do is I help a person who has a goal achieve that goal. I don't fix anyone. That's the other end. That's over in your ball game.
Well, we don't fix either.
Right. I just help you achieve that goal. I do what any coach does out there on the field. So, but I want to thank you, because, you know, I even say in my book, I knew all the tricks, but I still look for treats. And so that shows that I was still, you know, I still, that is the only venomous relationship that I can really get into and relive it, because there is still some unfinished business there, even with myself. So you may have just fixed something there, even though you say you don't fix.
Well,
just want to let you know.
Well, thank you very much for that. If I have been helpful, then I am more than pleased, because, you know, the reality is that that's what we do. We very often look at somebody else's bad behavior, somebody else's dangerous behavior, and we blame ourselves. And part of that blaming of yourself is, you know, I would suggest a sort of that unconscious wish to reassure yourself that you have control over it, so you can make sure it won't happen again. And that's
that
just not
so
true.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not true.
Wow.
So let's come back.
I try to tell people with just that, with that story, that, you know, people can be really deceptive.
Absolutely.
And the only thing that you should assume about any stranger, and this is another 911 piece coming in, we were trained to assume that we were not assuming. That was the only thing that we were allowed to assume, is that we were not assuming.
Gotcha.
And so I sort of live my life like that. I try not to assume things about people. I did a lot of assuming in the story that I just shared. I assumed that I knew what he meant when he said, there she is.
Absolutely.
No, there she was the woman that he was planning that looked like his ex-wife, that for some reason, I have no clue, you know, he wasn't going to do her, but he was going to do this woman that looked like her. I thank God that it was in the winter. I was a lot lighter in the winter. I had my tan on, and for some reason, some people don't think we get them, but I had my tan on in the summer, so I was a lot darker. In the winter, I'm like a totally different woman.
Which may have been part of what saved your life.
Tomorrow, saved my life.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want you to tell us how you got away from that very scary situation.
Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk, having a conversation with Tamara Neal, a certified relationship coach, author of Venomous Relationship, and herself a survivor. We'll be right back. with that man pointing that knife towards you. How did you get away?
Okay, well, Dr. Brewer, I'm going to save some of it for the book, but I will say this. I'll throw some things out there so that I can help that listener that is listening, because that's the whole point.
Absolutely.
What I did was I got in touch with my gut. My gut that I ignored in the beginning, it was no longer hitting me in the gut. My gut was actually talking. I got still. When he pointed the knife at me, my intuition said he wants to see, I could actually hear it, said he wants to see fear. Don't feed into it.
Wow.
And I didn't. I started looking around. I pretended right along with him like, oh, okay, you're still telling the story. You know, if I would have showed fear, then maybe he would have acted it out, looking back on it now. My gut said, don't show fear. But in the meantime, I was looking around, and I was thinking of all of the things that I was going to use. I was going to rip the whole apartment down. It wasn't a time for fear. I excused myself to the ladies' room, and I fell down in front of the porcelain altar in there and said, please get me out of here, and I'll save the rest for the book. But my intuition actually started talking to me. It was no longer a feeling of, oh, something's wrong. No, it was a feeling of, okay.
It sounds like
this is what you have to do.
It sounds like your intuition was jumping up and down and screaming at you.
That's right. And I mean, I could actually hear he wants to see fear. So when I didn't show the fear, he couldn't get into it. Maybe, I'm just saying the maybes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because when he pointed that knife, I guess I was supposed to scream and run all around the apartment. I didn't do that.
One of the comments that you make very early on in venomous relationships is the fact that women often have a really hard time admitting to being emotionally abused. Why do you think that is? And I would also add to that, admitting to themselves as well as to others that they're being emotionally abused. What do you think that's all about?
Well, as you know, there's no one size fit all.
True.
And one of the things that I know for sure, when a woman has been successful in many areas of her life, it is often very difficult for that woman to admit that she has failed miserably in the relationship category. That's one of them. The other one is a financial thing. They validate themselves with things, with the finance part. And I'm willing, almost like selling your soul, I'm willing to put up with this so that I can have that. Well, I always say that, you know, I refuse to be a doormat in your mansion.
There are so many women who do precisely that, particularly, you know, if their partner has a great deal of financial stability, or even if they have financial stability that they're afraid will be disturbed by leaving or separating or divorcing, they will stay in that place and surround themselves with toys and things and maybe even other people, telling themselves that it's okay. But in fact, what they're doing is they're selling their souls and they're selling their spirits. And both sides of that coin are very hard and very complicated, but it's absolutely true that sometimes people will stay because they fear the results of the not staying. You know, one of the things that you said that certainly happens with women, you said that she doesn't want it to, particularly the successful woman, she doesn't want to let anybody know that she failed miserably in her relationship. But actually, she's not the one who failed. Her partner, who's being abusive, is the one who is failing at being a reasonable, supportive, healthy, loving partner. But she will take that on as though it's hers. So many times, you know, people who are abused take on responsibility, as we were talking about before, take on responsibility for the bad behavior of somebody else. It's part of what keeps them in the relationship, because they keep trying to fix what is unfixable from their end.
So true. That's a really good point, too, because, you know, and I must rephrase that. That is so true. She hasn't failed. But in her opinion,
exactly,
she has failed. I know for me, it felt like I failed, you know. And we blame, especially if the woman is, and I'm not just going to say successful, women that take on that stronger role, they feel like it is their job to save everything and everyone around them. So if it goes wrong, if the kids go wrong, it's my fault. You know, and that is part of that abused mentality as well.
Absolutely. One of the points that you make in your book, Venomous Relationships, is that you should pay attention to how your date treats others. And how many times have we all heard somebody say, he treated so-and-so terribly, but he was really good to me. You're saying, pay attention to how he treats others. What are some of the things that we should pay attention to?
Okay, like you're driving along and a sweet little old lady cuts him off and he goes into road rage, flares.
Okay.
Flares, this guy is not in control of his emotions, you know. Another thing would be the way that he talks about the women around him, his daughter, if he has one, his mother, his coworkers. You're sitting there and this guy is really agitated by every woman that seems to be in his sight, and they're all dumb and stupid and this, and sooner or later, you know, that'll be you. And especially if he seems to have unfinished business with a past relationship, you know, because one of the things that I try to tell people is you really want to be on edge. You want to be on a lookout. Call it the BOLO list. Be on a lookout. And that's a police term when they're looking out for someone. And that was what the name of the book was going to be originally, but that's another story. But the BOLO list.
Okay.
So, you know, see how all of it intertwined, the 911, the life, the, you know, everything just kind of, so when I get that question, it's just like, I don't know. We're just here.
But you know, one of the things, just to digress for half a second, the idea of being a 911 emergency communication technician, so you know that every single day you go to work, there's going to be emergency. You know every single day, every single hour, every single minute that you're in that place, you're subject to being a part of a crisis. How did you deal with that?
God only knows, but I tell you what I had to do. And I still do it to this day. It has become a part of me, and I don't know if it's good or if it's bad. But I had to learn to live in the moment. I had to leave that thing that happened a minute ago, because when you sit down, you put your headset on, and you get your first call. Then you get, you know, and you may send that call in less than a minute. You should. And then you get your next call. Then you might get a call that you have to stay on the line with. Well, in the first hour, you might have maybe about 15 good ones. So you know how they would have the television version of 911, where you see the 911 operator say, oh, I was so worried and so concerned. I didn't know whether I was trying to. Now, you do feel that way when you have to stay on the line. But after you get off that line, if you plan on being there for any period of time, you have to move on.
Gotcha.
So I learned to move on. It's something inside of me where if something was distasteful to me, and I say it because, Dr. Brewer, I don't know if it's good or bad. If a person was distasteful to me, I will forget their name. Somebody whose name I should know. If they did something that really, you know, so I got developed this mechanism that I could just move on, block it out. And whatever was going on at home, I knew that whatever was going on at home, I had to forget about home when I went to work. And when I left work, I had to forget about work. I couldn't take work to work and couldn't take work home. Now, the only call that I ever really took home is if I delivered a baby. Now, okay. I come in high off, so I say, I had to go. And if for some reason you really felt like you actually delivered. You know, and they actually would hang that up in the 911 center. They would have up on the board, so-and-so had a boy, 3 a.m. this morning. You know, but some operator just never got to have a baby, and I had like four, so
wow.
I felt like I was one of the ones with a big family.
But, you know, one of the very popular almost buzzwords it's in the world today is mindfulness. And the whole goal of mindfulness, as you probably know, is to stay focused in the moment. Don't go outside of the moment. It's a way to reduce your stress. It's a way to sort of calm yourself down and slow yourself down. It's a way to focus yourself. So it sounds like you were doing some early versions of mindfulness.
Isn't that amazing? Before even what came about, so that's why I say every moment has brought me to this moment. I knew that the 911 center and all of that good stuff was connected, and I don't know. And you asked all the difficult questions. You know, how do you deal with it? You know, it's one of those things where you deal with it or you don't work there. Because it's so many people, the 911 center, they'll hire like 10 people, a session, a training period. They'll hire 10 operators. And when they bring those operators through, they would actually take bets on who you think's going to be around.
Interesting.
Because not everybody, and it had nothing to do with your level of intelligence. They had people that were paramedics, couldn't be a 911 operator. They had nurses that couldn't be a 911 operator because they were trying to be a nurse instead of a 911 operator.
I could see that not working.
Yeah, it did not work. Or a paramedic, and you know, they work from the other end.
So clearly it is, you know, I don't think that we think about the people on the other end of the phone when we reach out for help. And there's no particular reason why we should in that moment, but, you know, there are human beings on the other end. And maybe we need to celebrate them a little bit more than just societally we tend to do. I want to shift a little bit and go to back to your book.
Can I just, before you shift real quick, can I just throw this in since you mentioned that?
Yes, ma'am.
Because I am working on 911 Operator Breaks the Silence as we speak.
Wonderful.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that because a lot of people don't even realize that, like, for instance, I have been there taking a call and the guy said it was a bum in the building. After further investigation, realized that it was a bomb in the building. Now, during a bomb threat, you get all of the necessary information and you send that call. When that call is sent, in this case, the 911 center is located in a courthouse. That whole courthouse is evacuated immediately. Guess who gets to stay?
Oh.
The 911 operators get to stay, and you continue taking calls. They don't say, okay, everybody put their calls on hold. No. You continue taking calls, and they bring the bomb dogs through, and they do their work. That's a sense of, and when I look back on that now, you know, back then I didn't really give it a second thought. We went on with the day. But now when I look back on it, it's like, wow.
That's pretty extraordinary.
Uh-huh.
All right, so we're going to have you back to talk about, actually, there are a number of books you've written that we need to have you back to talk about, but let's come back to this book.
Okay.
You quote statistics from the National Domestic Violence Hotline in which you say an average of 24 people per minute are victims of rape, physical violence, or stalking. So I want to be clear for folks who still aren't quite sure what constitutes rape. And, you know, the myth is that it's the stranger who jumps out of the bushes in the middle of the night. And that's not true. That's the smallest percentage. But another myth is that if she's drunk or she's high or she's unable to give consent or say no, well, you tell me, is that still rape?
Well, if you're drunk and you're high and you're unable to give consent and I go in your purse and take something because of that, is that still a theft? Is that still... Is that still stealing? I think it's still the same concept.
Gotcha. And, you know, that's a great way to put it, because so many people will say, well, she didn't say no. Well, yeah, she didn't say no because she couldn't say yes. And sure. And they sort of ignore that part. If he hits her, but there's no physical evidence that he's hit her, is that still bad? Is that considered violence? If it's a push or a shove or something like that?
A push and a shove is an assault. And actually, if I get up in your face close enough, and I'm not going to quote exactly how close, where, you know, we all have these boundaries that are supposed to be reasonable, our reasonable space that we're supposed to have. Whenever a person comes and they get in between that reasonable amount of space that you should have, and you could probably have to look it up to see what it is, but that's an assault as well. You don't even have to touch the person. There are degrees to assault. There's first, second, third, and fourth. So that is an assault. If I'm screaming in your face and stuff is flying out of my mouth and I have you to the point where you can't move without walking on me, then I have certainly assaulted you.
I think that's such an important piece for people to pay attention to and to really understand. Let's talk about stalking. You know, the person who's sending flowers to your office every day, for example, or cards to your home every day. I remember working with a woman who every day when she would come home, her front door would be papered with cards. Is that stalking?
Well, I put it to you like this. If he's sending you roses to your job every day, my advice to you is take off the rosy-colored glasses, because
I hear you.
You may need to examine why this person is filling himself up with you. You know, because one thing we don't want, and I talk about it in the book, and I want to put this out there. It's a book, it's in layman's terms, and it's just a girl talk, and then we have a conclusion. And then today I will release and let go of pay. So it's just a regular coffee shop conversation. But one thing that we don't want to do is we want to be on the lookout for that person that's filling themselves up with you. So I would say that, and you would only, the person would be the only person that would be able to determine whether it is, you said stalking, whether it is stalking or not. Because, see, if I'm cheering it on and I want it, then it's not really stalking. That's the way that some people date. But when it becomes uncomfortable for you, for that person, that's where your gut and your intuition and all of that starts taking place. When I start pushing it away and you start steady bringing it, then that's stalking. But as long as I am still okay with it, because I don't want people to get mixed up. Some people actually, that's the way that they date.
Yeah.
They send a lot of flowers. And my God, I had an ex like that, sent a lot of flowers, and that was a venomous relationship. Sent a lot of flowers, and one day he actually sent, I just knew he was going to send flowers because he kept asking me what time was I going to lunch, and this big dirty bear got off the elevator.
I tell you
singing,
what.
Embarrassed me so bad.
While we're holding on to the thought of the big dirty bear singing to you, maybe we don't want to hold on to that. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want you to tell us about the playa from the Himalaya.
Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Women's Wednesday. I'm having a conversation with Tamara Neal, who is the author of Venomous Relationships. We'll be right back. Tamara Neal, you have written about the player from the Himalaya. Who's that?
Okay, the player from the Himalaya. This is a guy that you will more than likely meet in a club. You may have the time of your life with him. But when you get home, if you play it the wrong way, if you make him the superstar, and you play yourself like an extra, then don't expect to go home to meet mama. Because it's normally that guy that with the player of the Himalaya mentality. He is the only person that he's really in love with is himself.
Okay.
You know, or if he's not just in love with himself, if it's somebody else that he has in his corner, normally the player from the Himalaya, sometimes he's married. But the player from the Himalaya, that particular guy is unavailable for you. So what I try to do, I give a scenario, I try to give some of the telltale traits. And a lot of women fail this test miserably. And they have the time of their life, and they even take this guy home with them. They go home, you know, invite him into their house, and he may even spend the night. If he spends the night, you're done.
Really?
Because one thing I try to tell women is men are hunters by nature. They like to hunt.
Okay.
And once you have been subdued, if you have been caught, if you get caught too early on in the game, they lose interest in you. Once you become that one-night stand, forget it. You ain't got to worry about going home to meet mama in most cases.
Okay, you just don't have to worry about that.
They might look sad with the no, but, you know, you're going to look sad with that yes later on.
Gotcha. I hear you. So what are some of the telltale signs that you're dealing with a player from the Himalaya?
Well, one of the signs is he's in a hurry. He wants to get things started quick.
Okay.
You know, he's in a hurry, and he's going to tell you that stuff we talked about early on. Oh, my God, where did you come from?
Okay.
Some of the things with him, he may talk too fast or he might talk too slow. You know, that's one of the ways that you can identify that he's not being authentic. You know, if he comes off at you like a car dealer, my God, look what just walked in the door. Is that up? Okay, so maybe you want to slow down a little bit and look at that.
Okay.
Or if maybe he's talking too slow, he may say, when you walked in, I just looked and.
You got me. But we have to be really mindful, because that guy who's seeming like he's speaking so slow and deliberate and so intent, and he's so enamored with you and only you, you got to pay attention to what else is going on there.
Uh-huh.
Talk about Mr. Video Madden.
Well, Mr. Video Madden, there's not a lot to say about this guy, but I know he seems to be, other than the fact that he seems to be the style these days for a lot of our young women.
That's true.
Mr. Video Madden is that guy that plays video games while you go to work.
We know a lot of guys like that.
Uh-huh.
And we know a lot of women who come up with a lot of reasons why that's okay. He's creative. He can't be put into a box. He's just waiting for the perfect opportunity. I mean, I'm sure that in 10 minutes, you and I could run down at least 50 of the lines that women will give themselves about that guy.
Oh, yes, but you know what? It's a lot of women that are out there working hard, and when their man calls, you hear the video game in the background. Now, I ain't saying no more.
Okay.
I don't have any more to say about that.
Well, in that case, let's move a little bit over to what about the jailbird lover? Because there are a lot of situations where that is the case. Well, we know that that's real complicated, so talk about that.
It is complicated because there's no one-size-fits-all for this. Depending on what that, especially in the time now where we find out that so many people have been falsely arrested.
Exactly.
I'm not saying that if you're in a relationship and this person should for some reason become incarcerated, that you should just drop him like a hot potato. I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm not saying you should stay with him, depending on what the reason is.
Okay.
I made a mistake, and this is just for me. I'm not saying there's no right or wrong, but I made a mistake and didn't file my taxes. It's a whole lot different from I made a mistake and sold drugs.
Okay.
In my case, that's how I look at it.
It right.
But also, there's a number of reasons that I get into the book where women, I know of a woman who actually has been married 20 years to a guy who has never walked on the same sidewalk with her.
Oh,
she doesn't even have a clue what side of the bed he likes to sleep on. The only amazing part is that I noticed through watching this 20-year marriage is the fact that she's dedicated to him, and he seems to be getting younger and she seems to be getting older. Okay, because she looks like she could be his mother now.
Gotcha.
You know, and he actually, I studied this relationship. But what I say to women is, if I take a bird and I put this bird in a cage, that bird is going to sing to me. It's going to look to for any way that it can to entertain me when I come to that cage.
That's true.
But if I really want to know if that bird is really on my corner, I will never know until I open the cage. If the bird comes back.
Gotcha.
So it's no way of, you know, really, I try to, the hard piece is to tell women, you really don't know this person. If somebody's telling me when to eat, when to sleep, when to do everything, then, of course, I can sit there. I got all day long to think of something wonderful to say to you on the phone. Of course I'm going to write letters to you. And a lot of women, they romance that. Because
exactly.
It's like, you have so many women that have never had a man write them a love letter. You have women that have never had a man ask, how was their day? And I've interviewed incarcerated men, and this book is actually in the prison system. And my first relationship book, The World's Top 10, and the men loved the book. They loved the book. They said, I didn't appreciate how you put us jailhouse pimps out there, but you did a good job. Yes, I actually have reviews from prisoners.
Is that
now, if the men can love it, because we fail to realize, even though some of these guys are actually in the book, they have daughters, they have mothers, they have sisters.
Exactly.
They've seen this happen to all of them.
So is that book that you're talking about, is that The World's Top 10 Worst Men for Women?
Yes, for
okay.
Women guys. Those men, the men, they love it. As a matter of fact, I still get requests for that book. I try to make sure it stays in the prison system.
Well, you've just gotten another request for that book. We need you to come back and talk about that one.
Okay. All right. That was the first book. I was a little out there then, you know.
I won't tell anybody. What about if you are the mother of the person's child? What about, you know, what do you do then? They're in jail. You know, maybe they're in jail for years and years, but you've got a child together. What do you do then? Do you stay? Do you go?
It's no way for me to answer that, but it's for you to answer, because if you're in a even a person with a child, it depends how long is this person gonna be there, what is this person in there for. I've interviewed a young lady, and it's a really sad state of affairs that's dating a child molester in jail, and her thing is, well, he's a human being. He's paid for his mistakes, and he's not. How come people prejudge people, and you don't know what he's going to do? So, you know, you can't. I can't answer some things. Right. I just can't answer. I wrote the book. I didn't.
You didn't write all the answers, right?
I didn't write all the answers. Some things I just don't have an answer for. I just thought it'd be something nice to put on the table.
You know, you do need to pay attention to what they're in jail for, because
right.
if you're dating a child, somebody who's molested children, chances are by the time they've gotten to jail, they've molested many, many children, and it's a good bet that that will continue once they get out, if they get out. So you really have to be careful with that one.
Yes, that's so true.
What about
that's so
dating?
True. And I have that in the, not skipping over the book, but in that first book, I have Chester in there. And those are the telltale traits of a guy that may come into your home and molest your child, because it's something that I think women need to look at. We want to know if there is a child molester living in our neighborhood. How come before we bring these guys in, we don't investigate to see if we have a child molester coming in our house, introducing him to our children? We got to do a little more homework before we introduce people to our children.
Okay, and a lot of people don't think that way. They want, in fact, a lot of people will look to their children to tell them whether or not this person they're dating is okay.
That's so true.
And you're asking that you kind of be a parent and be a responsible parent and do a little investigating that we don't necessarily think about doing. We just don't. And I think what you're saying is maybe you need to. Not maybe you need to, you need to.
You need to. Because one thing that I grew to know, and Dr. Brewer, I'm sure you can verify this, when I had a brother who passed when he was 14, he had a brain tumor. I hung around a lot on the children's, I can't even think of the word, intensive care unit.
Uh-huh.
Told you when I have something bad, I block it out, couldn't get it out.
I hear you.
Anyway, the children's intensive care units. And one thing I learned there was, well, I noticed, was that on those intensive care units, these are the sickest children in the world in Johns Hopkins intensive care unit. And you don't hear one cry. You don't hear one snarkle. And I tell people in the book from noticing that you want to pay attention to what your child isn't saying. When they get
true.
Quiet, you want to, you know, everybody that's screaming and how, sometimes those children that are a little better off are doing a lot of making a lot of noise.
Gotcha.
Goes back to the 911 center again. I used to have women, people call, say, hurry up, get him out. He's not breathing, my baby's choking, hurry up, get somebody out there. And then you ask them, ma'am, is that the baby crying in the background? yes, hurry up. Well, he's getting air because this baby is, He ain't going to be doing that if he ain't getting no air.
Okay, I hear you.
His lungs sound pretty good from here.
So pay attention to what it, that is such a critical observation, I think, for everybody, everywhere, all the time, period. Pay attention to what is not being said as much as you pay attention to what is being said. I mean, if there's nothing that folks walk away from our conversation with today, and there's much to walk away with, but that, pay attention to what is not said, is absolutely critical, and we all need to do that. Very quickly, before we go, I want you to give me a one or two liner about the value or the lack thereof of dating married men.
Dating very married men, that would be the side chick, right?
Yes. Is that a good thing or a not good thing?
It's definitely not a good thing.
Okay.
I mean, I look at it like this. Why not have your own?
Okay.
Well, I have a few stolen moments, if you could have your own. And I tell some women, they look at it like, you know, I don't want a man around me 24/7, and I don't want to be washing anybody's laundry and this, that, and the other. One of the things, and if you really, if you want that married man and you're trying to take him home, I'm skipping over on it because it's so much, that's a whole show.
I know.
But if you're trying to take that man home, a lot of women that once they have, if they break the statistics and manage to get that man, they find that they don't like the man that they have. They say, what happened? You changed once you left your wife. But what they don't know is that man's wife was a part of who he was.
Exactly.
That it's like, how come you're not shaving anymore? They didn't know that his wife would say, my God, please take a shave. How come you don't dress the way you used to dress? Well, the wife was picking out the clothes. You used to wear a nice cologne. Who bought that cologne? Who was,
Sounds like we got another conversation coming up.
They were in love with the wife. So
gotcha.
Now that he's on his own, and he got to do his own thing.
All of a sudden, it's different.
Right, now she's picking the underwear up off the floor like, wait a minute, where did these come from?
All right. Clearly, we have to have you back. Tamara Neal, author of Venomous Relationships. She is a certified relationship coach, and she has much to share with us. Tamara, this is your official invite to come back. Is there a website or a place where anyone can go to get more information about you and about your books?
Okay, well, my name is Tamara Neal, and that's T-A-M-A-R-A Neal, N-E-A-L. If you Google me, you'll probably get everything. But my books are also available at Amazon. They're available at most online dealers, Barnes & Noble. And my website is www.tamaraneal.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Tamara, for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. You take care. We will be back in touch.
Okay. I can't wait.
Okay. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Remember, you can listen to this program and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. You are encouraged to send your comments or questions to me at mindtalk@aol.com. Again, that's mindtalk@aol.com. And folks, if you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. But the best way to be in touch is mindtalk.org. And remember, always, always remember, if it's unacceptable, well, then it's just plain unacceptable. Take care.